This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. With me is Eric Baker, who is making a life as a poet. Whatever was he thinking? We're going to find out now. So Eric is teaching at the University of Maryland, which is his alma mater, a graduate of St. John's College of Annapolis. So he knows a little Greek, a little French, a little Latin. And now we're going to hear an opening poem. Here's Eric.
Thank you, Grace. It's a pleasure to be here. This is from a larger project called In Don Su. When day breaks, when the sea hoists the sun high above the flat of the head, when the gulls begin to streak, cut the measured trickling rays with the sharp wires of their wings, when sailors begin to throw their wind and hoist along the docks below, when the sea turns its face and turns again onto the jagged rocks, the shoreline base, when the warm mellow confounds, when the sneak assault, the jumbled speech, the thoroughfare air, I raise my chin and count the lulls, the waves, open my eyes. Open my eyes, the soothing rumble, the white hill crests, the toppling fills. I, walking along limping sandbirds and the hisses and the dry and the waving yarrow of the dune, damp morning, needles dropping, yellow leaves trampled and cracked. I return home. Nothing changed. He sleeps still. He ignores the world all day. Hearing me tiptoe and slide open the door, he asks, "Are you leaving already?"
Oh, Eric, this is my favorite poem you ever wrote. I'm not kidding. I love this poem. This is a prose poem, which means you've gone from margin to margin. What makes it a poem if you've gone from margin to margin?
I guess a little quick history lesson. Baudelaire and his contemporaries want to arrive to the prose poem after an effort of breaking past the fixed Alexandrian, moving the sentence from one line to the next without a grammatical stoppage for melodic reasons. Mm-hmm. The prose poem comes out of that sort of experimental development, it seems, where there's a desire to break, there's a continued desire to break out of line and margin and to run with a sentence, to follow, if not the melody of the sentence itself, the sort of logical melody, right?
Oh, it's beautiful. Even better than that. I mean, well, it is the sprung line. So here we have a line that goes from margin to margin. But what's in that line? It's how you repeat consonants and vowels, how you get the lyricism. Just listen to these L's. Warm, mellow, confounds. I raise my chin and count the lulls, rumble, the white hill crest, the toppling fills. Oh, my. It is just absolutely a work of art. And it is purely because of your repeating vowels and consonants. Sharp, wings, sailors, sea, oh, shoreline. The repetition of these sounds is what makes a work of art.
Thank you.
Thank you, he says simply.
I can only be thankful.
Also there's a character in case we get lost in the wallpaper. Yes. then you introduce a character. Why did you bring someone into the landscape?
I suppose I was more interested in what this character was receiving via impression and what these impressions could detail about how this character is relating to others in their world, which you learn if you stick with the long poem, who else they're dealing with. This is adapted from a really ancient story in Korean culture that has its roots in shamanism, in pansori, which is Korean opera, if I could translate it, in Korean novel writing, a story about a single father who is unseeing, or blind, and is taking care of his teenage daughter. The teenage daughter, over the course of the story, decides to sacrifice her life for the sake of her father's well-being. And this is really a narrative that's really ingrained, in my opinion, within the Korean consciousness, in which I really wanted to look at and think about, I guess, generational conflict, fathers and children, or parents and children. And
so he's the one who sleeps all day. But you've gone beyond that. You've used that as the germ, but you've tossed that seed aside and you've taken it up to a whole other level of sheer impressionism and language. Is this part of a longer work?
Yes. Yeah. It's an attempt, not at a pansori in English, though there are Korean American artists who are interested in that sort of work right now. But yeah, a longer narrative sort of poem, exploring not only this relationship between parent and child, but a sort of responsibility I feel young people, especially now, have to rectify the wrongs of the past in more than one way. One thinks of climate change, one thinks of intersectional social justice movements in the past 5-10 years. And so I'm really trying to think about those pressures today through this really ancient story.
So all of that is bubbling up inside of you, and what comes out is this absolutely melodious, luscious combinations of sounds. So I don't care what is hydrating you. I like what's happening to you. Let's go on. And so the next long series I saw was Mok. Say it right.
Well, but who knows if I am saying it right.
Yeah. Well, most of your work has been energized by your identity, seeking your identity, being both Korean and Jewish, which both have tremendously rich legacies. You could just draw forever from each. So what we're going to hear now is something from that longing. And tell us an overview of Mok.
Yeah. So Mok as a project is a long form, I'll call it a sequence, I guess, divided into four sections. One of those sections is far more prosaic. Another section is lifting from the tradition of Shijo, which is a Korean song form. I think some of your previous guests are big fans of Shijo. Yet I'm doing something a little different. There's a very niche form called Sasol Shijo. I might be mispronouncing that. But
how many pages is the whole Mok episode? Many, like 15?
65, 67, maybe. I'm doing some editing.
Whoa, we're going to have a taste of this. Let's have the first taste.
In Hangul, some sounds are drawn to resemble the tongue's posture within the mouth, how it rests within the mok. Sound like ga makes a tongue shape like gun, and so on. According to family myth, our ancestor was a minister for King Sejong, or Yangjo. Let's say Sejong, who invented the Korean writing system. We drank so much, the king banished us to the paddies to farm the rest our days. I like to dream a history where we delayed the development of the national script, that there was almost no Hangul without us, that there was almost no Hangul because of us. I am told, if your mother is not Jewish, you are not. If your father is not Korean, you are not. Kol Nidra. And a girl asks someone beside me if they've brought another of their goy friends to shul. I am told that to understand, you require context, explanation, outside knowledge, linguistic inclusion. At a bus stop, a lady chatting with me guesses that I'm Korean. No. You sound like a Korean. What does a Korean sound like? I speak so little Korean while buying cigarettes at a mini mart in Seoul. I gave the cashier 2 panic attacks. When I ask Uncle what kind of dwaeji, he smiles, turns the red mass over coal, and points to his throat.
Love it. Wow. What is important to you about this? Why are you writing 65 pages of this? What is important to you?
I feel like if I spend my time listening to other people about issues of identity, I don't exist. If I follow the old ways to the T, people like me, we don't have a category. And so a part of this project is an effort towards a sort of personal self-determination. Now, I am not Korean or Jewish. I am my parents' child. And this is a distinction that I don't make, but others seem to want to make for me at times, especially in the literary world where we have a new push to be more inclusive, but people are still learning how to do so in a polite manner.
I like very much what you say, that if your father's not Korean, then you're not Korean. Of course, it is quite the opposite. Your father's Jewish, and then your mother is Korean. And if your mother is not Jewish, you're not Jewish. So that right there, that little conundrum in the middle says everything. And you're puzzling out quite a history and a selfhood and a literary career. That's a lot to do. Let's hear another one.
Yes. This is from the same long project. One thing you should know, I use this word Jindo. Jindo refers to a Korean dog breed, one of which I grew up with.
There's a Korean dog breed?
The Korean dog breed. It's known for being very loyal. There are stories of people abandoning their Jindos, and the Jindos follow them across the country of South Korea. And so I would ask my mother what this word means often growing up. And she would be playful, and she would almost mistranslate at times the name of the island where the dog comes from. And I always thought this was interesting. The more I learned Korean, how this became apparent to me. I used to ask Umma what Jindo meant, besides being the name for the breed. Sometimes Umma would say, way of truth. Sometimes she would say, island of truth. Umma let the sounds for do and do blend in the ear, translating something not as wrong, but as novelty. Whole childhood, I imagined that walking the Tao was no different from sitting squat on some island, from letting the river smooth the shores without concern for how much sand remained below the grapple of my toes. These days, I'm low on sand.
Are we going to go to another one, or do you want to talk a bit?
I can, yeah, if you'd like. Okay.
Well, I love the way you read, because you love your words. And if you don't love your words, nobody will. Mm. And I don't know where you learn to do that, but you're, in a way, you kind of trust the listener not to go away, not to turn the dial. You trust the listener because you trust your words. It's as if your ego is nowhere in the room. You just trust the language. And that is something I'd like people to hear, because the one thing, when people read their poetry, they are apologizing every minute for the poem, where you are not. So I want to hear you read again, Eric Baker. I'll tell everybody that your writing has been published many places by Gulf Coast, West Trade Review, Tupelo Quarterly, Washington Writers Publishing House, other places. Born and raised in New York City and a graduate of the University of Maryland, and lives near there and teaches there, and is a proud graduate of St. John's College of Annapolis. I want to hear your voice.
It's the hottest time of year. Pre-deluge. Landlocked in Chungbuk is a vessel for stagnant air. My cousins keep telling me how sorry they are. I have to spend all my time in Hanguk, apart from the sea. I keep saying, I'm here for family. I'll see the ocean next time. Last time I was here, two nukes were parked in the ocean, round the bend. I was looking for you. Up, down, palace-ridden boulevard, sun-drenched in my suit, sweating like the monsoon, begging for your approval. Smoking in a shack by my hotel, I made shisha from everyone's miserable frickin' face, watching each bull-necked ajushi craning to duck the next guy's puff. In the smoke, swear I spotted you rushing these Myeongdong streets, young, steel-lipped, wearing your suit. When you were young, you believed. His back turns to me like a page in a book someone else will close. I want to ask him about my grandfather. I try in broken tongue. I ask him if Haraboji was a farmer. No. But he knew his harmonica. Gyopo in the South learning the blues. Imagine that. I wonder if he would have taught me a tune and which.
May I say that it takes a seasoned writer, although you were very young, to end that way and not to tie a knot in the bow, because ending with that fans out all possibilities. And what made you allow yourself to do that without getting afraid to do that?
I think something I learned at Maryland with Josh Weiner, and this is not an absolute principle, but it's something I think about all the time. How often do we write past our true ending? And I am in revision. I'm always wondering, am I two beats too far? I've reached the end of a poem. Am I a few beats too far?
I like it. David Keplinger would just love you for that, because he's the master of the open end. As Emily Dickinson says, we dwell in possibilities. So you give us all these possibilities. In the previous section that you read, you have two lines by themselves that say, I was looking for you. Mm. What did you want to accomplish with that stark volta? What did you want to have happen? Because it is a lyrical poem, and then all of a sudden this abrupt person tells us something he wants. So did you want to shock us? Did you want to make us ache? Did you make us want to wonder?
Well, I confess that I think little of the audience when I draft on a revision. I keep you all in mind.
Please keep us all here. In mind.
I will. I always will. But yeah, I suppose there are certain moments where lyric cannot convey the intimate. There are moments where it can. There are moments where the poem must change, and this was in moving towards a certain truth. And so the movement was complete, and it was time for another change.
Thank you. Ilya Kaminsky has this wonderful poem about the war, and it's so dreadful. And mm-hmm. in the middle of it, he just has a line, I took my chair and sat outside in the sun. Just that interruption of all the horror made it come together. And that's the way I felt about your poem, when you interrupted it with those two lines, I was looking for you. It's as if you're summoning the reader almost, the listener. Well, I think we have more, right?
We do.
Let's have more of Mok.
You know, who said that poetry is an act of summoning? I feel like this is a line that's been floating around my head.
Maybe I think I said it.
Maybe you said it.
I hope.
You hope so. You copyright that. I'm going to continue from Mok. I'm going to do two sections, but I won't pause between. The red stones playing purple beneath my feet. How the stones waddle. My uncle's black polo. My uncle's gait. Like my own, stiff-shouldered, morose. He swings his arm like he's still in the army, holstered. The water is muddier on one side of the pier, clear on the other. The waterfall is dry, little stones piled along the path, humid. My uncle explains the mountain. I ask him about stones. He says people come to pray. He mimes, his hands pressed together. Then he touches his heart. Mom. I touch one stone, so small. No one would miss it. I think about taking it. Don't. Putting it in my pocket. The mountain whispers. Mm. You know, I spent my whole life not knowing who in my family I resemble. In one photo, finally, I see Halmoni's face. I see Amma's. I see Samchung's. I see Nuna's face, Hyang's face. Standing in a field, my grandmother, her hand behind Amma, the sun in their eyes, bouncing off their gingham parasol, the grass crunching beneath the sole, mugwort, moss, and dandelions atop a sunny hill. Two children play, barreling through the grass at the bottom. Up top, men pass a dunghill, then watch it burn on a grave.
You had me at the gingham parasol. I hope that these are recognized for the significance that they have. And I'm wondering, if people are ever objecting to the Korean in the line or something they don't understand, is that ever a stumbling block? Or can we intuit what you mean just by the context? I mean,
Wait, what were you saying, please?
I got it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if I say a word in Korean, I still understand it because of the surrounding words.
Yeah. Well, it's a complicated issue for me. I am inspired by Asian American and African diasporic poets who are unapologetically not just using their own language, but being attuned to what registers are available to them in their own lives. And, you know, so they're not looking at a dictionary, but they're being authentic and genuine with what's already known. I feel like there's this pressure as a mixed race Asian American poet that if I'm going to include the language of either side of my ancestry, I must be fluent, I must know the grammar. The truth is, I know a few words here and there. I use the Korean name for family members. I find the Korean spelling for places to be far more pretty compared to the very ugly diphthongs required in English to translate Korean sounds. Because visually, it's abhorrent to me. And so I use Korean and sometimes Yiddish or Hebrew, sometimes Hanja, which is classical Chinese, where I think it feels natural and right. And in that way, I kind of perhaps shut out the audience in some superficial way, but I hope my audience takes it as an intimate way of including. And I'm using a register that they don't understand, but yet I still care about connection, as paradoxical as that might seem.
It's understandable. It's like you trust.
Yeah.
And it's in your DNA, and you're very much in touch with such a rhythm inside of you that has I think, developed slowly, maybe, because I knew you as an undergrad and you're very fluent, but there's another elevation here of sound and meaning that has happened, I guess, from writing. What else can it be from? Is from writing. But, you know, I also think you are the master of the prose poem because of the internal sprung line, which means the way you find a lift, a lilt inside the line, so no one can call it, say anything but poetry. So I want to hear another prose poem if it's okay with you.
Yes, absolutely. This next piece is an excerpt from another long project called Rambling Elegy, which is in some way an ode to New York City. Every New Yorker has to have a New York poem, and this is just one part of mine. Mm-hmm. And what used to be here? Here you trampled sticks, jammed laces and soles against the cracks of a granite and chihuly sprinkled earth. Here you raced up and down a sandstone block, a Redford hunting dog held by the leash. Here together you two slipped through the toothless, leaning on their canes, the children you used to shoot finger guns with at the park, whose fathers' little plastic bags were found, hearsay, in the homes, on the persons of every old timer on the block. Sped past a lady in leopard print, would call you darling, angel, love, from her stoop. Sped past a percussionist who wrapped a conga under his arm, squeezing in and out of red brick frames to get to the next big gig. Here you slipped through and past and would scramble on to the big brown church, all brown, drop of burnt butter in a great skyscraper skillet. And by that church, the neighborhood would gather, and you'd feel the bass of everyone's voice and gait, shaking asphalt and granite and trees and your toes and your feet. And here you two would bang a Louis, that means turn left, and sprint past the bagel mill and hit the slope down concrete vineyard paths, where the river crashed against the rocks and rusted barges made their tumbling, roughing rumble on gray waves, where the mayor lived in his big yellow house with his big chandeliers and his big posse, where flautists once danced on one toe, bronzen among bluebirds, where you'd kiss the cold, saying, this place, this, where sheets of wind rustled against the muzzle of your ruddy hound, staring off snug between the rungs, overlooking the swells.
May I just say, red brick, big brown, all brown, burnt butter. May I just say, ruddy, staring off snug, rung, ruddy, snug, rung. Come on. I get it. I get it. Does that just come out that way?
I think in that
this
period,
this is pretty smooth. Yeah. It doesn't look like you ironed it out.
I think over the course of a few years, I may have learned a little bit more of prosody and abandoned it and played. But I think when I was writing that, I was really into the idea of improvisation. Not that I understand it too much now, but I'm always trying to listen to the next tone after that.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was an exercise in that sort of practice.
And a travelogue.
A travelogue.
We see it. Does the mayor really have a house like that?
Yeah, currently, if you go to New York, there's Gracie Mansion. It's still there.
Is it yellow?
I think it's yellow. This might be the imagination playing
tricks.
This
sun.
Might be the poetry. It could be the sun. It should be. There's not a posse anymore, though. It's a more of a friendly crowd out here.
I wanted you to write a book called A Walker in the Streets, although that title has been taken, because you really did note what Manhattan was to you and New York, and living right in the heart of it too, with your big Jingo dog.
Yeah.
Always
yeah,
by your yeah. side. So there's so much more I want to ask you. Do you remember the Haibun
Yes,
the
of
Japanese
course.
Form?
Always,
Okay.
Always.
And how do you describe a haibun?
Haibun is, strangely enough, it reminds me a lot of how Western thinkers have thought about epistemology and memory, insofar as here I am in the prose section. So there, for the haibun, there is a very terse, usually first-person active prose section in English. And then a very crystal haiku refrain that takes all that data and compresses it. And it reminds me of how some people have thought about the human mind insofar as here I have all this data in front of me, visual data or sensory data. And the imagination must rearrange these pieces of information to arrive to a thought. In a way, the haibun reminds me of that process or encourages me to be mindful of those internal mechanisms inside mind.
Well, I remember one that you hark back as a child, if you can find that for us.
Yes, the dry cleaner, would that be?
That is the one.
That is the one. I'm going to pull out the cleaner. The cleaner. My mother and I walk home. It is dark out. Wind is cool and soft. Lampposts dirty, yellow. The streets are empty, clear, except for outside the Korean dry cleaner. Mr. Yi is standing, clutching his wrist. He does not wince. Red stain down tan trousers, pool of blood at his feet. In Korean, my mother asks him if he is okay. Mr. Yi says he was just trying to bring down the gate. My mother asks if there is an ambulance coming. He nods. He says yes. He smiles. We walk on. I look back. He stands there alone. I am nervous. We shut the door to our building. Muffled sirens, late evening, clenched fist on the corner, bleeding calmly. He nods, pants soaked, distant sirens, the steady heart.
The effective thing about that is that it's in the present tense, which is kind of a marvel because it happened in the past, but making it immediate, happening right now, is the secret of the haibun and the secret of Eric Baker, who is really writing extraordinary, fresh, new, innovative verse. Let us have a final poem.
This is a piece that was published recently in West Trade Review. I'll just give you a little context before we jump in. I'd written this poem while traveling South Korea, visiting family after a recent death. And this part of South Korea, you can kind of see evidence of a declining birth rate, or at least of a lot of young people moving to the city and out of these areas, these more rural or remote areas. And I also found a very old sewing machine that harkened back in some way to the colonial past, indirectly. And I was curious how both the past and the future were kind of haunting me in this one moment, in this one lonely street in the middle of South Korea. Footprint. Walking behind Amma, empty Chuncheong Road, car humming like bees. Amma points. A shuttered store, toys, stationery, Hangul fading. Remember. Now uncle lives down the block. House, makeshift, shuttered, school. He's left rubber padding. Each step, colored footprints up the stairs. The children, no more here. Not as many. just an old singer in the corner. Needle rusted. Body Japan. Finish. The land was half. It was another's.
Say those two lines again at the end.
The land was half. It was another's.
So much history in those few syllables. This is The Poet and the Poem. That is the voice of Eric Baker. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank our funders, the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, Avide Shoshani, Young Ki Kim Renault, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. My name is Grace Cavalieri, and Mike Turpin is our engineer.